Hey folks, welcome to the latest episode of If You've Come This Far. In this episode, we are talking to Captain Chris Chowdahill, commanding officer of the USS Dwight D. Eisenhower. Chris, remind me again how you found Chowdah.
Found him on social media. I really appreciated what he was doing to make his sailors and crew members seen. He was posting like daily pictures of young sailors sitting in his captain's chair on the bridge of the Ike, holding a couple cookies, smiling, and then he was saying what they did, right?
Like,
And so we spent a lot of time talking with him about his sort of what we call manifesto on leadership, which I think resonates with both of us quite a bit. I think it's super transferable, way beyond just an aircraft carrier, way beyond just the military. And so I was just drawn to the way he was leading these people and recognizing them and seeing them. So reached out to him and he was game. And yeah, it was probably last summer while they were still on deployment. He's an impressive guy, leading a strong, really strong operation.
So what you didn't reveal is that you were looking for a way to sneak in another Navy guy into one of our conversations so you could, you know, talk Navy talk.
I didn't say that because that's not what I was doing, Sean.
Okay.
Yeah. I was not doing that.
Okay.
But you know, it's funny because
trying to make me look like I don't know what I'm talking about, because then I got to use all this language, and Chowdah goes into all the acronyms and shit. I'm like, how does he remember all that?
I mean, know
it's crazy.
It came up a couple of times.
Yeah, it did. It's crazy.
We spend so much time exploring mental health, connectedness, leadership, etc. I'm like, talk about a fucking petri dish or a test case for how to lead people through difficult mandates.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah. I mean, an aircraft carrier is a great case to study.
Yeah. And if people don't know, I mean, it's a floating city. I mean, I had no idea. I had to look up to say how many people are on this ship. And, you know, it's like 3,000 base and then another 2,000 of airmen, right, when they come on. So 5,000 on this boat, you know, it's a floating city and he's running it. And I think his manifesto, The Way of the Warrior Sailor, is an amazing doc. Take that title off it. And it's a way to live. I mean, it really is.
It is. And we won't spoil it by telling you what the three requirements are, but I love the three requirements for that.
Yeah.
I will say I have one regret, and that is, and we talked to Chowdah for an hour and 20 minutes or so. I regret not inquiring about the call sign, Chowdah.
Well, you talk about it at the beginning too, and we didn't. I
think I intended to get there. The reason is because, you know, everyone knows Top Gun, and, you know, you got Maverick and Goose and Iceman. And the one thing I do know, and I'm a submariner and not a surface sailor or a pilot or a naval flight officer or whatever. So I don't know everything, but I do know that you don't get to pick your own call sign.
Right.
Like, I have a friend, maybe I've told you this before, but I have a friend who was a F-14 NFO. And his name is Tom Tench, T-E-N-C-H. Do you know what his call sign is?
No idea.
Butts. He's Tom Butts Tench.
Yeah.
So, you know, I don't think there's a lot of Mavericks floating out there in the real world, but maybe there are.
Yeah. We could guess that Chowdah has to do with the fact that he grew up in Quincy, Mass, and that would fit. I mean, he's saying, you know, Boston accent is gone away. I don't know. It sounded pretty strong to me, but.
Ooh, it's still way stronger than your Boston accent.
It is. It actually is.
Let's get on with the show.
Fascinating conversation. Yep. Let's go.
Here we go. Chris Chowdahill. Chowdah, so nice to meet you.
Nice to meet you as well. Thanks for having me, and thanks for letting me have a week off so I could get well after my flu. I might have to cough a few times. No big deal.
That's okay. Are you feeling better?
Yeah, much better. More energy. It's all back. feeling good.
I feel like I should start talking on this call like Ben Affleck or Matt Damon so I can keep up with
you can fake Bostonians. You can fake it.
I have lost probably 80% of my accent at this point. And because I've been away since, I guess I was 22 years old. So I've been away longer from the area than I have been in the area, Boston area. You the same? Yeah.
I grew up in Northern Mass and left in 86 for Chicago. So I've been.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Yeah. And we pick up some of the mannerisms and vernacular of the places we go. So I say y'all all the time now. I love that word.
You know, the thing about y'all, and I would love to adopt that because I use, you know, you guys, even when I'm talking to women, which feels weird, you know?
I do it as well. Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, that's a whole Midwestern thing.
Is it?
Yeah. You guys?
Yeah.
It's a Northeast thing too.
Is it?
Yeah.
I use it all the time. I don't care if people get offended by that, but I think people generally understand it. And my daughters do too. They say you guys, so they picked up some of me. But y'all is so convenient. Yeah. Just rolls off the tongue.
It's one syllable, right? Like you can't do that. Efficient.
I have adopted it. It's mine now.
So how did you guys connect? I don't even remember. And then it's two Chris's, so I'm just going to say Captain and Chris. So Chris.
That's right. Yeah.
A lot of names, a lot of nicknames and names will be thrown around, but I'm going to try to be respectful of the call sign, which maybe we'll get into a little bit later. But I think that Chad is probably busier than me, and so I may have a better recollection of how we connected. I'm guessing that's true. Is that right?
Yeah. Yeah, because I've done a bunch of podcasts recently, and I just completely lost track of who's who and and the dates. I had to print out my own calendar of like the entire month because you know, you can't really see it that way that well on the computer. So I went old school to keep track of my life.
Well, so this is how it happened, Sean. Like I spend a good bit of time on LinkedIn and was just sort of for many months had been sort of admiring the way that Chata was, in my words, humanizing his crew, right? Mm-hmm. And celebrating and recognizing and seeing his crew and helping them to feel seen. And we'll get into this a little bit later, I imagine. So eventually I was just like, wait, we got to talk to this guy. Like this is a unique approach and it seems super powerful and transferable. And so I think originally I reached out on LinkedIn and said, hey, what do you think about coming talking to me and my partner? And Chata was super responsive and seemed game. And I think it was probably second quarter of 24. So you guys were probably on the third trimester of your extended deployment.
Are we talking about the second fiscal quarter of 24? Okay. Well, that'd be January, February, March.
Second quarter of calendar year 24.
Okay. Yeah. Okay. That makes sense. Yep. That makes sense. I didn't do social media until, I mean, I did a little bit, but mainly just Facebook. And then we got the Wi-Fi system installed on the ship prior to deployment, which was around September, October timeframe of 2023. We pushed and pushed to get this thing. We had it a little bit sooner than that. And we realized one receiving antenna with Starlink wasn't enough. Like having so many people on the ship just pretty much crushed that system. So we got multiple antennas, which allowed us to have just like a modicum of the ability to just text to, off ship, which was awesome. And then I was like, okay, I would like to do some social media. So I talked to my public affairs officer. She was a lieutenant commander and she's an expert on that stuff. And I said, okay, what can I do? She said, okay, let's do something like X, which was a little bit more lower bandwidth. And so she set up an account for me and kind of gave me the boundaries of what I can and cannot say. And there's a lot of restrictions in what I can out there. There's a lot of, and some of it's self-regulation. And so I just, started doing X and then people, and I had three followers. One of them was the ship itself. And then it just kind of took off from there. And then I started trying out some other venues like Instagram. And then I figured out through Instagram, you can put stuff, you could simulcast onto Facebook and another thing called Threads. And now I got Blue Sky. And then I was like, you know what? I'm already on LinkedIn. I might as well just dump the stuff on there too. So anytime I do a post, I usually put it on all the venues simultaneously. And so that's kind of how it started. And you know, other people started doing the same thing. But the weird thing about it was I was doing it while we were in a combat zone in the Red Sea, which was the most unusual thing. And I don't know if that's ever been done before. Maybe someone in the Army did it, or the Marines when they were on the ground in Afghanistan and Iraq. But to do it from the Red Sea, from a Navy perspective, very unusual, plus very hard to get Wi-Fi on these ships. So we're starting to put these on other ships. And we have found that people like it, obviously, you know, because we get to talk to our external support network, you know, like our families. I call it the external support network, but I mean, it is a support network. Like when you're having a crappy day, you don't always want to go to your chief or your chain of command to solve your personal problem. Sometimes you just want to, you know, have someone listen to you from home. And so that offered that venue. So, yeah. And it just
was
it took
was
off.
Was that your objective, Captain, in starting to engage social media? Was your objective to – what was your objective?
My original objective was to share my leadership philosophy because I thought it was pretty good. Of course,
it is.
It's my own, so obviously it's the best, right? But, but I thought it had some value. And I put some time into writing the leadership philosophy. I called it the Way of the Warrior Sailor. Mm-hmm. And it was like 26 pages long. I did this in early 2023. And there was a reason behind it. I was trying to sort of re-energize a ship that had kind of a rough history. There's a lot of cynicism and negativity. I'm like, we need to get back to positivity. We need to claim that we're the best damn ship in the Navy. And the hypothesis in there was that morale can lead to success. So I needed to figure out what is morale and how do we create it for people. And we learned some things along the way. And we could talk about that if you'd like. Yeah. But I wanted to talk about that on social media in little chunks. Eventually, I started taking pictures of sailors, you know, the people that do the actual work, you know, young people, usually around 19 to 22 years old. And then the parents saw that. Now, the parents wanted to get more, you know. Yeah. And as a parent, like whenever you get like a newsletter from school, you're always looking for a picture of your own kid. So we needed more pictures and they just wanted to see their sons and daughters. So I started getting thousands of requests. I could not keep up with it. But every day I would try to put at least one sailor on there and just maybe tell a little bit of their story in a couple sentences. It's the best I could do.
How many soldiers under your command?
We have 3,000 sailors. Yeah.
3,000. That's what I thought.
And then we had an additional 2,000 on the ship from the air wing.
Yeah.
So it's really, and I took care of them as well, even though I wasn't technically their leader. But so 5,000 people, you know, little city.
Yeah.
And, I didn't even scratch the surface of the amount of people that did all the work. I had a few hundred out of the 5,000 represented on the social media. So, I mean, so, and the other thing is like, you know, there's stuff being said in the news about the attacks that we're involved in the Red Sea and not a hell of a lot being put out about how we're actually doing. Right.
Yeah.
And so I was able to say, hey, we're doing fine. And here's this sailor that, you know, works as an engine mechanic and he's proud of what he does. And he's a regular human being. And so there was a recruiting component that sort of came out of this as well. And I won't say that I was reaching young people because nobody wants to follow an old man on social media. but I was definitely getting the parents and they do have some influence in the recruiting process. I do believe that.
Okay, so age has come up twice now, and I know that the first time it came up, Sean got all grumpy. But I do want to take a slightly unorthodox detour here and ask Sean a question. And it's a quiz. It's a quiz question, Sean. who do you think is older, the Ike or Chowda?
Well, Chowder's like you're 54, something like that.
Still 50. Yeah.
Still going 50. On 51. Slow your roll, dude.
Yeah.
That's right. No, that's right.
Right. All the same at that age.
So the ship is older.
The ship, I think, is a little bit younger, right, Chris?
Yeah, it's just a little bit younger.
Yeah.
It was christened in 75 and commissioned in 77. And we go by the commissioning date as like the official age. Mm-hmm. But I'll tell you, components on the ship are older than, you know, 47 years old. So.
Yeah, I bring that up because the submarine that I was on was the USS Trepang, and it was a couple years older than me in the 90s. And it, you know, it's just like, I always tell people are like, how do you not go crazy on a submarine? You're like, well, you start with a 30-year-old submarine, and you figure how much time are you going to spend fixing shit, right? So, you know, you're just busy, and not just fixing shit, but drilling and everything else. So that's the last time I'll bring up age. I know that the Ike has an amazing story, and you've talked a little bit about sort of maybe the brand that you were trying to rebuild, but I'm kind of more interested in your story, at least to start, Chata.
Okay.
Like, can you give us a few beats on like, how did you end up a naval officer in the first place, and then when and how and what went into your decision to make it a career?
Well, my dad was in the Navy in the early 70s on the USS Kitty Hawk, another aircraft carrier. And he was an aviation bosun mate equipment, ABE. These guys are the salt of the earth. They're tough. They work on catapults and arresting gear, and that's it. And so he did that for a deployment in the Gulf of Tonkin. And I was born in 74. And so I would ask him to tell me stories, and he told me stories about his time there. But, you know, he'd say things like how tough he was, and then port calls in like the Philippines. And he took a lot of pictures. He had a camera. So I have a stack of photos that's several inches thick, mostly black and whites. And, you know, and half the pictures that he's taken of his friends are they all have their middle finger up. And
I got a lot of friends like that.
Right, right. We all do. Like things never change. Right?
So yeah.
And that's another thing about, like, we could talk about generational differences. I don't believe in that at all. And that's contrary to everything you hear. But we're all the same. In essence, he was my guide. And then I said, you know, I'm going to do this. He said, I want you to become an officer. I'm like, what the hell's the difference? He said, well, you got to go to college. I said, okay. So I did ROTC. I applied for that as a junior in high school. It's right around the same time you start applying to, you know, either the ROTC programs or the Naval Academy. I did apply to the Naval Academy. I decided not to go that path, mainly because I was following this other girl, and I thought I was in love with her. And so I decided to go to the civilian college path. But in any case,
some things never changing, right? That's a timeless story.
Right. You know, we're young and, you know, in love, and that relationship lasted less than 1 year. So whatever. So so I did that, and I wanted to go Intel because I as a poli sci major, you know, slash a little bit of international relations. So Intel seemed like that thing to do. And then eventually maybe become a lawyer. And I did none of those things, obviously. I ended up, they took away the options for Intel. So I had to do something that was directly war fighting related, so to speak. So I had to be a surface warfare officer, submariner, or an aviator. Navy SEALs was on the path, but I was not in the physical condition at the time to compete in that environment, nor did I want to. I said, you know what, I'll do aviation, seems pretty cool, maybe I'll be on aircraft carriers. And so I also had terrible eyesight, so I had to become a naval flight officer, NFO, which is not a pilot, so you ride in the back. I said, okay, I'll do this. And I requested F-14s or E-2 Hawkeyes because I could be stationed on the West Coast and be closer to Boston. I wanted to go home. So I was still tied to my home.
Yeah.
And, you know, I was thinking about that. And so ended up getting picked for E-2 Hawkeyes. And very interesting aircraft. You got five people flying it. It's like a mini AWACS. We control the airspace, the air battle. And it could be pretty exciting during, you know, real combat operations. And, you know, I'm in the back with two other dudes or gals. And, you know, we're running the mission back there. It's pretty cool. You know, speaking of women, like right around that time, you started to see a lot of women going into aviation, whereas there were still some squadrons that didn't have women in them yet. So it was kind of a transition point in the Navy around 1996, 97. In fact, the USS Dwight D. Eisenhower was the first ship to allow women to serve on it and on a combat ship.
We're proud of that.
Yeah, that was 1994. And, you know, I talk to a lot of women nowadays, and I'm like, you guys don't realize that you're still, trendsetters. You're still making history. But we all take it for granted because we all, you know, grew up with women in the military. It's not a big deal to us. In any case, So that's the path I went at through aviation, and that will eventually bring you to the option of being a going to the what we call the nuclear aviation path, where you get qualified as a nuclear operator, and you can now command an aircraft carrier, which is what I did later in life.
Well, I think for one thing, Chowdy, you and I should agree to spare Sean and the listeners nuke school stories, and you know, let's
thank
just
you,
keep
thank
that.
You, gentlemen. Yeah,
I mean, there are some interesting stories for sure.
Yeah, I'm sure.
So
episode and so, two.
Yeah, I put it. I'm putting that all behind me. I want to forget that stuff. Yeah. That was hard
let's
stuff.
Let's not relive it.
No.
So you did. So you were. At some point, you were taken out of the plane and given a department head tour before nuke school?
So, or how? Well before that. So in order to be eligible for the nuke school slash, you know, CO of a carrier path, which is like a second career, you had to command a squadron. So I was a department head as a lieutenant commander. What was this around like 2007 to 2009? I was based out of Japan and with a squadron. But eventually I commanded a squadron from the East Coast. Mm-hmm. And then from there, you become eligible for the nuke path, if you will.
I'm going to get a little personal here. At what point did you get married, and how was the decision making around, hey, I'm going to stay in? Because look, I think most people appreciate our soldiers and our sailors. I think more people should appreciate their families because of the sacrifice they make. So how did this decision make? I mean, obviously you didn't just go tell your wife, like, I'm going to stay in for a career.
Well, I started dating my wife in Norfolk, Virginia around 2004 when I was still a lieutenant. And it was sort of a setup. She wasn't interested in me because she had lived in the area and there's a lot of Navy people.
Right.
And she's like, I don't like Navy people. She had kind of her own preconception of what we were like. And but I convinced her to date, and it went well. And so we ended up getting married in 2005. And then, you know, not too long after that, the option to go to Japan came up. And this was tough for my wife because she was a radio DJ, kind of very popular in the area. And so we joke around that I ruined her life and brought her to Japan, right? But we had a great time in Japan, and we eventually had two kids, two daughters.
How long were you in Japan for? She stuck with it.
It was only for a 2.5-3 year time frame. Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, a remarkable place. I still talk about it all the time. I was talking about this morning with my daughter how crazy that place is. But you know, you show up, and next thing you know, people are bowing to you, and you're trying to bow back, but you're very self conscious about it because you've never done it. Yep. But you eventually get pretty good at it, and you know, and then driving on the wrong side of the road, that kind of stuff.
Oh yeah.
It was just a very interesting place, and they're so kind to us. I would love to go back there.
So your two daughters, are they teenagers now? How old are they?
One is 12, and one is 18. So one is in college, her first year at music school up in New York City.
Mm. Nice.
Yeah. Yep. They both love music, so my 12-year-old wants to do it too, just because the older one did it. They would be terrified knowing that we're talking about them right now, and this is going on the internet. So let's be careful here, okay? You're gonna get me in trouble. Okay? Yeah. I'm so in trouble.
I mean, Sean's not cleared to have these conversations anyway. He doesn't have the clearance. Well, I will say that my 16-year-old, both my daughters are also musical. My 16-year-old plays guitar, writes a lot of music. I love how these young girls are empowered by the Taylor Swifts of the world and the Sabrina Carpenters and all these other people. So, God bless them, right?
I think it's great. Like, I look at it as one of the reasons why we serve is to protect that culture, right? We live in a culture where you can do things like music and not have to worry about your own personal survival, right?
Right.
Yeah. So we protect those things. And so the arts, that's a big, big thing in my family. In fact, this weekend, I'm going to see a Michael Jackson tribute. I'm not sure what it is, but this should be kind of fun. But my wife takes me to all the musicals that come to the area and stuff. And it's a lot of fun.
Dude. I saw the Michael Jackson musical. I don't know if that's what you're going to see in New York City with my daughter a couple years ago.
Yeah.
If that's what you're going to see, it's amazing.
It's coming. It's playing in Norfolk as well. So, you know, the off-Broadway stuff comes down here.
I love that. Hey, listeners. I started testing this app called Mental in late 2024. and I've used it literally every day since. Mental is designed specifically for men's mental health, and I can honestly say that I've felt the impact. Handling stress better, building resilience, and feeling stronger really both physically and mentally. So every day I take a cold shower and I knock out a round of push-ups with coaching from a retired Navy SEAL and a former world heavyweight boxing champion. And while I was skeptical at first, probably even more skeptical than I was about cold showers, I've also been using Mental's AI therapy function. It's not meant to replace real-life therapy, but I have found it to be surprisingly valuable. What sets Mental apart is that it's not based on pseudoscience or bro science. It was developed by PhDs in neuroscience and counseling psychology. So it's real science designed to make a real impact. So if you're looking for a way to strengthen your mind and body, I highly recommend giving Mental a try. You can download it using the link in our show notes and get 20% off your annual subscription. I really don't think you'll regret it. So your wife got, you know, she stuck with you. Despite the fact, you know, not despite the fact, knowing that she was going to be a Navy wife.
Right.
And so thank you to her and to your daughters as well.
Thank you.
Can we dig in? Sean, I don't want to hog the time here. I'm just so you can see. I'm so jazzed.
You don't want to? Oh, is this different? Is this different?
This is usual, right?
Yeah. Our interviews? Okay.
Okay, look. Let's get into the way of the warrior sailor. If that's
there we
okay.
go. There right? we go.
Because, I mean, again, yeah. that's what impressed me most was the way you were seeing your sailors and recognizing them and helping them to feel seen and appreciated. So I've read your, you may object to me calling it a manifesto, but I've read
can
it.
I make I a, love... can I make a comment about that?
Yeah, please.
Sure.
So when I picked it up, I started to read it. So if people know it's 26 pages, something like that. But in the intro, you say, I intended to have a one-page command philosophy. And I don't know the way my brain works. It immediately went to Jerry Maguire when Jerry Maguire said, oh, no, it's a mission statement. No, it's a memo. It's no. What? It, and I'm like, oh, right. So Chowda started out writing a one pager and ended right. up writing.
Yeah, you get the manifesto. Yeah, right. The original name was The Proclamation, which is really lame. And it was a sailor who said, hey, you know, because I would every time I talk on the 1MC, which is our, you know, intercom for the whole ship, I would always end with this is the way, sort of a Mandalorian tribute. Uh-huh. And so someone said, you know, one of the sailors like, why don't you just call it the way of the warrior sailor? Because I use the term warrior sailor in the so-called proclamation. Uh-huh. So that became the actual name. I love branding. Yeah. So we can say, you know, we have a command philosophy with a name, right? You're not that's something you normally do. So I'm big about the branding stuff. The words that you use, but the essence of it is it goes back to something that my CO and I came up with. My CO and I, this is when I was the executive officer, second command of a squadron, this back in like 2011, 2012. And we realized that, you know, if there's one thing we could focus on to make us the best squadron in the Navy, what is it? And we said, it's morale. But then we try to create an equation for morale. Morale equals what? It equals, you know, having, you know, positive relationships, health, food, job satisfaction. And then we realized that, you know, one of the things that we can truly control is the job satisfaction piece. Are they proud to work there? If they're proud to work there, we should see morale happen or be created. And that should result in better inspections, better results in combat, or better reputation. All of it matters, right, in this business. So we wanted all that. So that was the first thing. And then I started to realize that there were some of the greatest military commanders of all time said things like, and I'll quote Eisenhower here, our namesake, morale is the greatest single factor in successful war. Napoleon said similar things. It just goes further back in history. They were all saying something to the effect of when you have morale, it will tip the scale in war. Mm. So if that's the case, this is a big deal. This is like a big finding. If morale is the thing, then should we not create like a government commission to look at how to create this so that we could, you know, have it everywhere? And I realized that this would also apply to any business, any school, any sports team. Yep.
We're all saying the same thing. We're using different words, but morale is the thing.
You know, morale leads to esprit de corps, which causes people to just care a little bit more. And if I can get 3,000 sailors to care just an inch more, imagine the results we would see.
Right.
So, you know, in that manifesto, I also mentioned, you know, what is morale? What is it not? It is not happiness. We confuse these terms. Happiness to me is more, and people disagree with the terminology, but happiness is more of a chemical reaction of the brain. It is fleeting. It comes and goes. We love it. We want it. Happiness can also contribute to morale. But I argue that morale is deeper. It's spiritual. It's really hard to put your fingers on and quantify. It doesn't mean someone's smiling all the time. It doesn't come from having more time off, you know, because if you're not working, because you take lots of time off, then the job suffers and things start to fall apart, especially on a 47-year-old ship. You have to maintain that thing constantly. But people still need time off, so I have to be very careful about that. You still need time off so you can have things like relationships and these other things that matter to morale that I don't really control as much. So we try to balance this. I mean, this it's a balance and act, but you definitely want to get you need to have high standards. You need to get things done. And when you get things done, you can now reward people for getting things done. So backing up, how do you create morale? Number one thing is to love and value your people. You have to do it. There's probably, we can make a list of 1,000 things you can do to love and value people. For instance, just giving them a pat on the back saying good job, or taking a picture of them, give them a cookie, put them on social media. And then that causes a loopback effect where now the parents are like very excited and they're talking to their son or daughter, you know, all these things, that's a relationship building thing. So to love and value people. And the corollary to that is if people are not loving and valuing their people, they need to be held accountable. Ooh. You know, toxic leadership has got to be, we got to get rid of this, right? I have heard too many people say things like, hey, I'm old school. I mean, what does that mean?
Oh, yeah.
Does that mean we just treat people like crap, or we tell them to do something without explaining why? I mean, how does that work? To me, that is a fallacy. I argue that my form of leadership to love and value people and the focus on morale is old school. And I know this. For instance, I went to the Navy's USNI website, U.S. Naval Institute. They have articles written by naval commanders going back more than 100 years. You type in the word morale and you'll see people talking about it in like the 19-teens, the aughts. You see people talking about it after World War I, before World War II, and after World War II, during difficult times and transitions. And all those military commanders are saying the same thing I was saying. Morale matters, and there's ways to get there. So this, I'm old school. I don't know what this old school, like treat people like crap kind of leadership is. I don't buy into it, right?
Hey, Chris, real quick, if you would go back to that library at the U.S. Naval Institute and search for the word love, how many times do you think that would show up?
Ooh, I would say probably none, but I have not done it. So that's a challenge. I will
just think that's what's great about your framing of this, right? You're digging a little deeper into what is morale based on. So sorry, Sean.
Yeah. So I have two questions on that, because I think it's important to share Chris's actual words if people have, you know, when eventually hopefully they read this. But in this point, you say, I realize it's a big request, but without loving and valuing our fellow humans, we become less human. And so I have two questions. One is, how do you define love? And secondly, where I really started, my brain started working hard on this is in section 3, you talk about your mission and your vision. And, you know, the mission is to launch and recover aircraft to stomp on bad guys. And you actually have a disclaimer in here about stomping on bad guys. And so the friction between this issue of stomping on bad guys and loving all human beings is to me, as I started to think about that, inside your mission, you know, because, you know, loving all human beings.
Right. Right.
But that doesn't include the bad guys, or, you know what I'm talking about? It's like, how do you reconcile those two things?
Welcome to the central Christian struggle of all time. Right?
Yeah. Right.
Right. Right. Right.
This is not, and I can only speak from a Christian perspective on that. And I'm not really allowed to speak from a Christian perspective. I am no expert. But I know the basics, right? What is love? I think as we get older and we experience more love, we tend to I wouldn't say we struggle with the term. We understand it more broadly, and I think in its very basic essence, it is just showing care or compassion or having some empathy towards other human beings. It is not that hard. There is a whole study on emotional intelligence, or It's sometimes called EQ versus IQ. Mm-hmm. IQ is kind of static. EQ can grow over time. You can get better at it. That's the current, the prevailing theories, right? And, mm-hmm. and I believe in that. So that's what love is. It is just building this connectedness. And I think as we get older, it become that love becomes less transactional. Like when we're young, it's maybe a little bit more self-centered. You're trying to gain that love. And as you get older, you try to figure out ways that to give that love, and you're not always expecting something in return. Mm-hmm. And, you know, that's something that parents go through, obviously. So that's the love side. But yeah, then, you know, and we'll get to the disclaimer in there, but the second most important thing about creating morale is to give people mission and purpose. Mm-hmm. And a part of that is defining the mission. So I was recently at a couple different organizations. I was at Saab Incorporated, where they build one of our radars. I was at Johns Hopkins University's Applied Physics Lab. And one thing that I took away from both of those organizations is they actually love their mission. They're very proud of what they do. And that causes employees to actually have a little bit more job satisfaction. Like the people like working there. Mm-hmm. I wouldn't say everyone does, but most people do. And I hope they do a good job of the love and value piece where, you know, when people are being toxic, they do something about it, because that can be a stain in any organization, in any chain of command. So, yes. Yeah, so at the end of the day, we're still the military. Mm-hmm. Our job is to defeat enemies. Like we have no other, that's our main mission. I translate that with a little bit of a severe terminology. And again, some of this came from sailors when I was saying, how should we define our mission? And I said, our basic mission is to launch and recover aircraft. But there must be a purpose behind that. We don't just do that. Our job is to defeat enemies or to stomp on bad guys. And what's interesting is we were talking about this well before we went to the Red Sea. And of course, we went to the Red Sea and did just that. So we actually fulfilled our mission perfectly. You don't always do that in the military. You know, a lot of times you're acting as a deterrence, and that's good and that's very important, but you don't actually do the kinetic portion as well. So we ended up doing that. But at the end of the day, yeah, this is the struggle. Our job is ultimately to kill bad guys. And it's hard to say that. It feels awkward. It feels unloving.
Yeah.
But I just hope that our cause is just, that the people doing the hard work are struggling. And I've known a lot of people who've been involved in combat operations that involved killing people, and they do struggle, but you want that struggle. That's what makes us human. Mm-hmm. And so maybe there'll be times when you might be given an order to, you know, destroy a target, and you realize I can't destroy this target because there's a collateral damage concern. Say, mm-hmm. you know, a target is right next to a house that we didn't see originally, and there may be, you know, children. Anyway, this is not my expertise here, but stuff that we do struggle with, and we don't, you know, we still want to maintain the moral high ground ultimately, right? So. Wouldn't you want to have people in these positions with the ability to pull a trigger that have that kind of reasoning in their mind? Yes. So they will make the right choice at the end of the day.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's what I hope for anyway.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. So the desire to be loved and valued, the desire to have mission and purpose, huge. I think we've all experienced the importance of that personally. And then this, you know, the power of being successful. So continue with the third, I think.
The third one I don't talk about as much is there. Every human has a desire to win. Mm-hmm. I think that, you know, I've also met people who just don't seem to care, right? I'm not reaching everybody here. I'm trying to get the majority, but I think most people want to win. It's built into our DNA. So what's interesting, as a leader, you can create wins out of nothing. You're the one, as a, say, a manager of people, where you'd say, this is what we're going to do all week for work. And then we determine when we've completed that, and we declare a win at the end of the week, right? Say, nice job, everybody. We got what we, you know, said we were going to get done. It was well-structured. You all did a good job. We made a mistake here and there, but, you know, we learned from that mistake, and we'll apply next week the corrective measure, and high five to everybody. You just won. So if you create that environment where it's happening regularly, I think that's that it contributes to morale as well.
So Chata, I think, I don't know if I got the exact dates right, but I think you took command of the Ike maybe what, half a year before this deployment to the Red Sea. So I imagine the ship was already working up to that deployment.
Yeah.
What did you do when you got to the ship and took command in terms of assessing how well the Ike was meeting these three requirements?
So I took over like March of 23, submitted the philosophy, said, please read it. Not everyone did, but a lot of people did. I started doing what I call CO's calls. A lot of commanding officers do this when they take over a command. They will gather everyone together, usually on an aircraft carrier, bring everyone to the flight deck, thousands of people. And you say, okay, here's my philosophy and go execute. Nice job. And you carry on with life. During COVID, when I was in the command of another ship, we couldn't do that. It was a LPD-24, the USS Arlington, had a crew of about 400. So I was only allowed to have 10 people in a room at a time because of people wearing masks and all that stuff. So I did 40 different CO's calls to hit everybody on the ship, all 400, and about an hour a piece where I'd explain the philosophy, tell stories, answer questions. And it was really, we built this connectivity and the sailors liked it. So I said, you know what, I'm going to apply this to the aircraft carrier. So several times a week, I would do a CO's call with like 10 to 15 people in my little office area. It's a nice little fancy import cabin we use to like, you know, impress dignitaries. And we did this a lot. And gosh, I think I've had more than 2,500 people go through that office in these little groups.
That's great.
And I put a pause on it over the past few months because of our big transition to the shipyard, but I'm bringing it back. Hopefully next week, and I'll do it a couple times a week because we have huge turnover on the ship, you know, about 60 to 80 new people every month and that are coming and going. So it's almost like we're a different crew now. So you never can stop your information or your communication strategy. You just got to keep it going. So that was one thing. We also do command climate surveys that are mandatory. So we get a lot of information out of that. And we take action on every negative thing that's in there. Some things we can't solve. Sometimes it's a complaint about a boss. And so we'll, you know, if we know who that boss is and that person's name, we'll talk to them and say, hey, what's going on? And try to root out some of that toxicity. We did a little bit of that. And then, of course, we have CO suggestion boxes where you put out this little box and people can put a complaint or whatever. Sometimes they just want to talk it out. They'll put it in the box. And then I would address those pretty instant, rapidly, like same week, I would talk about some of the things that were in there and what we were doing about it. So we tried to create this like responsiveness to concerns that was pretty darn rapid. So one of the tenets in the Way of the Warrior Sailor is rapid, relentless, repetitive, positive communications. You just keep it going, right? The positive part is important because there are things that are bad that need to be addressed, but they're usually a small segment of that population. So I'm not going to go out on the 1MC and just, you know, start publicly blasting people and flame spraying because of the negativity of a few. We deal with the few on the side, just like praise in public, punish in private. And then in the public, we're unrelenting positivity and reminding people that they are the best damn ship in the Navy and to act accordingly. So that's the way.
Yeah, that's important. Well, yeah. And my hypothesis would have been that the desire to have mission and purpose would have been your least concern of the three. So I was thinking, well, what do the 3,000 or probably total 5,000 crew members of the Ike need more of when you got there? The desire to be loved, or was it already a successful ship, or did it need some work?
I would say as we got through 2023, initially when I took over, we failed a few inspections. It wasn't looking good at all. Our retention and reenlistment was the worst of all 11 aircraft carriers. We started getting better. We started figuring out our own problems. We started organizing better. We were meeting more often. I know meetings are a pain in the butt, but you still got to do it if they have value. And then we did our Comp2X, which is our certifying 6 weeks at sea evolution to prove that we can deploy. And we did really well there. That was awesome. And then I started to see our reenlistment numbers change. We became the best of all 11 carriers right before deployment. And then things changed. On October 7th, Hamas invaded Israel, killing 1,200 people, including 40 Americans, and took more than 250 hostages. And we're still dealing with that to this day, right? And then we were supposed to deploy the next week anyway on our regularly scheduled deployment. And so we deployed with a different mission. The thing that kind of stunk was that prior to October 7th, we were telling the crew that they were going to hit multiple port calls, which is an awesome part of being in the U.S. Navy. And all throughout Europe, we even visited a few of them as for site surveys, and we determined that they were good for an aircraft carrier. When we come into town with 5,000 people, it's got to be a substantial town to handle the influx of us. You know, we do pump a lot of money into the economy, but we could also cause problems to an economy or town and suck it dry. So and this was important to the crew because a lot of them were on the two previous COVID deployments in 2020 and 2021, back to back, didn't see a damn thing. And they were pissed about it. So we're like, okay, this is good. Everything's changing. We're the best damn ship in the Navy. We got the Way of the Warrior Sailor. Everything's starting to improve. Reenlistments are coming up. And we're about to do this epic 7-month deployment where we're going to see all of Europe. It's going to be awesome. And that all changed. So our first major test was going to be this deployment. Could we maintain the morale that we had tried to build, or is it going to go away? And we struggled because it turned out into a 9-month deployment. We got extended a couple times to stretch it out. The Houthis got involved. Next thing you know, we're 6 months of those 9 months. We're in the middle of the Red Sea, pretty close to enemy territory, and trying to fight them every single day. And I'm telling you, every single day stuff was going on. And it was very busy, very dangerous for not just civilians, but also for the U.S. Navy. And some people say it was the most complex naval operation since World War II. And I believe that to be true. And the sailors performed admirably, even though they were mad that they weren't hitting port calls, that they worked every single day. They did 7 days a week, 6 days a week, or the first 6 days of the week are 12-hour fly days. It is busy. It is hot in that region, terribly humid. And the ship is old, so it has trouble keeping up with the air conditioning. We get our air conditioning from the coolness of the water. If the water is 90 degrees, forget about it, right? So, yeah, it was nasty. And it was really hard for a lot of people to sleep. And yet, they persevered. Despite all the nonsense you hear about this generation is weaker, that's all nonsense to me. I got to see that young generation perform admirably in those austere conditions, right? I'm so proud of them. I love talking about what they were able to do, even down to the 18-year-old is just simply turning a wrench or pushing paperwork. They did it every single day. And, so that's the thing I'm most proud of, I think, about the U.S. Navy.
I'm going to be snarky here.
Yeah.
In case you don't know this, Chris, the way you can solve that hot water problem is just go deeper, dude. Just go.
We can't. No, I'm not a submarine. Now, this is the funny thing about the Navy, that people that there are we talk about inner service rivalries. It's like inner service rivalries that are pretty pungent. I love joking about that stuff, but at the end of the day, we're all one team, right?
Absolutely.
And when it comes to fighting, we fight well together.
Well, I do. I want, there are a couple things in the way that I want to get to. So let me, one of the ones that really resonates with me, Chris, is tactics. Give a damn about mental health. And one of the things that you said, you start with that, I want to know what you mean by it, because it really resonates with me. It is my belief that mental health issues have plagued humanity for at least 100,000 years.
Yeah.
What's that belief? Where does that come from? What's your perspective? Why do you say that?
The first indicator would be, how soldiers, airmen, and sailors have struggled in combat situations after the fact. We had terms like shell shock. We eventually went to PTSD. And it seems like it's something new every time. It is not new. Like, we struggle. That's this extreme end of things. In terms of depression, suicide, this is stuff that has plagued humanity for the entire existence of Homo sapiens, right? Mm-hmm. Has it gotten worse at times and better at times? Yes, it probably is on some sort of cycle. I think the COVID situation made it pretty miserable for a lot of people, especially young people who are stuffed into their rooms, and not able to socialize with other human beings. When we start to lose that human connectivity, the face-to-face, people suffer. But yes, I think the human brain is extraordinarily complex. it hasn't really changed much in those 100 years. And it is, we have, part of life is suffering. There is some degree of depression for everybody. I think everyone at some point in their life has been at a point where they felt like they had no value whatsoever, right? That meant going back to being loved and valued. And it, in those moments, you have some pretty dark thoughts. It's going to happen to everybody if it hasn't already happened. Now, having said that, I think we're doing a good job nowadays to destigmatize getting some help. Mm-hmm. Not just talking medications here. Sometimes it's just simply talking to people. And unfortunately, you know, as a society, we didn't have the resources for that around COVID. Like, it just weren't enough providers for the number of cases. As we've destigmatized this, now it's okay to go talk to someone. So the system's got to be able to accommodate. I struggled with this in 2023 because the ship itself did not have adequate resources until right up at the beginning of deployment, where we got a few therapists. We even got a dog. We were just more prepared to handle any concerns that popped up. And there were plenty of concerns. But I'll tell you, what we found is that incidents of what we call suicidal related behavior, whether you're thinking about it or you want to act on it, dropped significantly on deployment compared to prior to deployment, because I think we added all these resources. And I also throw in there some of those morale resources, like having Wi-Fi. Now I can connect a little bit better with people. Yeah. I think we brought in a USO center. So I love the USO. We asked them, hey, can we build like a game room? And they said, absolutely. And they helped us build this huge game room where sailors could go visit, you know, went off in their free time, which was pretty rare. But I'll tell you, we had more than 3,000 visits per week in that one little space. And we had, I think we had like 250 volunteers that manned it 24/7. Again, on their off-duty time, which is limited, they were sitting in a room trying to take care of it for other people. It was just remarkable how that whole process worked. Those little things, I think, helped a little bit in the aggregate. And having all the mental resources, mental health resources helped. Having the dog was very new to me. I was kind of skeptical of this program. I'm like, where's the dog going to pee and poop? Where, you know, who's actually taking care of him? Because that's extra work. And so we figured it out, and we got some help. And he was great. I mean, I love seeing him. I still love seeing him. He made me think I was his best friend. And I think that was the secret of dogs. They make you all think you're the best friend, and maybe he just wants snacks. And I did provide him a lot of snacks, but it was helpful. But anyway, I think that maybe that answered your question.
Well, yeah, because I what I really loved about it is just the acknowledgement that as humans, because I kind of agree with this, we have this voice in our heads, right? And it's always going. And so at some level, we all have what I'll say is mental health issues. And for some, it just managing that voice can get, is easier for some of us than others. And and so I just think normalizing and saying, hey, we all got a little something going on is really good.
Right. And my issue is like, I have a bias and an agenda here. If the mental health issue goes unaddressed, it spirals out of control, and I lose that sailor. Whether I'm not saying it necessarily a suicide, but they have so many problems that they can't function at work, and and it's time for them to go. I don't want that. I needed every sailor I could have. We've had recruiting problems in recent years for reasons I don't know. It's gotten much better since, which is awesome. But we just had a little lull there, and so the my manning situation is not optimal. I have sailors doing the work of, their normal work plus an addition to a sailor that's not there. I mean, you could probably do the calculations. You're doing the work of 1.1 people, whatever it is, right? Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So I can't afford to lose anybody. So that's why I want these programs to work. So I get people back in the fight and actually defeat the enemy.
Yeah.
Chadha, so my boat in the 90s had just over 100 sailors and officers. And also at that time, by the way, no women. You're on a ship with 5,000. This is a city, right?
Yeah.
My questions are, A, how many psychologist billets are do you have? Like, and how many do you think you need?
I think we found the optimal number. What we have, when you bring the air wing on board with all 5,000, we have five chaplains. They're all qualified to do therapy to some degree. we had an actual clinical psychologist active duty. We had a licensed clinical social worker active duty who can provide therapy. We had a civilian, what we called a deployed resiliency counselor, DRC, who could provide therapy. And then we had one other person we called the life boss. Their technical name was, this is a hard one, Embedded Integrated Prevention Coordinator, EIPC.
Oh, God. Gotta love the military.
I had to practice that. But she was awesome. She would provide classes on anger management, stress management, conflict resolution, all the kind of stuff that gets people back into the fight when they're veering in the wrong direction. And she was a great person, too. They were all great people. That cadre, and oh, we also have behavioral health technicians. These are junior sailors who are corpsmen that are the intake for anyone who's got any issue. So they hear everything, these BHTs. Uh-huh. And we had two of them. Two might be the bare minimum you need because they get busy. Originally, we had one and she was way overworked. Like, I mean, there were times like she couldn't eat because she had to take care of someone. So they're the first line of defense and they're super important. It just goes to show it takes that whole team of people of all ranks.
Right, right.
You know, our senior chaplain is a O5. He's a commander all the way down to that E5 plays into this program to get people back into the fight. I think it was the right amount based on the statistics we saw in terms of the reduction of suicidal related behavior.
Yeah. So if I'm a 19-year-old E1, what, and I think, God, I don't know what kind of help I need, but I know I need help. What do I do? And how do I know that that's what to do?
Everybody that shows up, they go through indoctrination. We actually call it Warrior Sailor Academy branding. You know what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm.
So in that indoc process, they get told about the resources. Those people come to the junior sailors who are just showing up and explain how to go about the process, right? But we also train our leaders to do that. So if someone's having a crap day and, you know, the true first line of defense is your chain of command, right, which is the thing we used for generations anyway, we prefer them to do that work before you send them to someone who's a professional, you know, psychologist or whatever. But in any case, I think we had the right people there. Did that answer your question?
Yeah, it does. You know, and I'm on the board of a nonprofit called NAMI Chicago, National Alliance on Mental Illness. Sean and I are here with you, partly as part of our men's group, Men Living. And so, you know, sometimes you need a professional, sometimes you need therapy, sometimes you need medication, need just peer support or something else. Are there other strategies that you guys use? Affinity groups, men's spaces, women's spaces, book groups, you name it.
Oh, yeah. The tons of, you know, side organizations that, you know, sort of grassroots that the sailors would come up with. Some of them are just like, you know, Magic the Card Game, you know, bringing people together, or Dungeons and Dragons, or some sort of multicultural group, Hispanic Americans, Caribbean Americans. They were a popular group. So when they're off duty time, they would gather together, bring people from different commands, got like 13 different commands on that one ship, you know, with their own leaders. And that would break down some of that stovepipe, bringing people together. So the bottom line is, as much as you can bring people together so they're not alone, and then share in some of these problems. I think that is, I keep talking about first line of defense. There's so many first lines of defense. The first one is your peers, right? So I need to rethink how I communicate this. I am not an expert on mental health, right? You know, what I tell leaders, and I can get in trouble for this, but I have to say it. You know, one of our jobs is to be positive, right? And there are days we are not positive. We feel like crap. We got to put on that smile, even if we have to fake it. And you take all those negative emotions and you push them down. Now, this sounds ridiculous, and no therapist would ever say what I just said, but it is the cost of leadership. Like, we do it. This is the damage we do to ourselves. Having said that, we still have to do something about it if it starts to affect us, right? And it will affect us. Don't get me wrong. It has affected me over the years, and you try to find outlets other than things like alcohol or drugs to overcome those issues.
So It's February 1st, 2025, and one of the tactics in the document is drive diversity and inclusion. we're reading a lot about it these days. It's been a subject for a while now, and I'm curious, just, you know, your current perspective on that and how you're doing it and where it's going to go for you.
Well, there have been changes due to the new administration that we are supporting, right? And no problem there. Most of that stuff doesn't actually affect the tactical warfighting unit.
Yep.
Because we are focused on warfighting, and that is our main goal. What I say in there is, like, we don't pick the people we get, right? We get who we get. And as a leader, you have to now manage those people and make it work, right? So we already get diversity. It's like, you have no control over it.
Yeah.
And we look at diversity as not just a function of, different color skin or sex. We look at it in terms of the way people think, their socioeconomic background. We look at the whole picture because of the complexity of the human person, right?
Yep.
So at the end of the day, I've got to make that work, right? Now, I've had to change some of the language in that document because of the change. No big deal. It does not change the essence of the Way of the Warrior Sailor. I'll send you version 2 here soon. But so that most of that shouldn't affect us at our level.
Would that make it politically correct version, Chris?
Well, I guess so, yeah. I have to follow orders. And,
I know you do.
Just the way it is, right?
Well, I wasn't even sure if I should bring it up. But.
Right. No, it's fine. But yeah. At the end of the day, we're already diverse. Like, we just have to make it work for everybody. Right. And I like the fact that we do have a meritocracy, at least at my level, where if you work hard, we'll get you to that next rank. We'll fight for you. I don't care who you are, right?
Yeah.
And so we'll make that work, and we have to, because when the bullets start flying, most of that other stuff doesn't matter, right? Yeah. All those little differences, we're just backing each other up and watch each other's back so we can get the job done, right?
Yeah.
We can't let you go without having asked you, were there moments in the Red Sea on that extended deployment that caused you particular anxiety?
Oh, yeah. A few times, but I have to be careful here. If I talk about this stuff, I'm like feeding into the enemy's desire to psychologically affect us, right?
Yeah.
But, we're all human beings. I worried about all 5,000 people on the ship, and that was a little bit of a mental burden on me, right? Did that cause me to perform less? No. I did fine. Now, there were a few moments where I'm like, oh, man, this is real, right? And so I took some deep breaths and I carried on. Like, that works for me. But, yeah, it was definitely a challenge. I'll tell you, though, even if it's not combat, being on an aircraft carrier with the amount of things that could happen, how dangerous it is any given day – will fuel anxiety in any normal human being. So, that's part of that's the challenge of being in command and that at that level.
Yeah.
So when you talked about the comment you made just a little while ago about, being a good leader, stuffing the bad day shit down so that you can lead appropriately, but ultimately have to release it in some way or deal with it in some way. How do you do that? What do you do for yourself as you're, dealing with those stressful moments, or you're dealing with those emotions that are difficult for you? What are the steps that you take?
I don't have like steps, but in the Way of the Warrior Sailor, I talk about sleep.
Yeah.
Sleep, it will reorder the brain and do a lot of healing for you. So as leaders, we fight very hard to get ourselves sleep as well as our people. Hard to do in the environment of an aircraft carrier where the noise is unbelievable. It takes a lot of adjustment for people to deal with that. And of course, being in that hot environment, in any case, we still have to fight for it. Part of it is how we configure our watch rotation. Someone must always be on watch. Mm-hmm. So we have to make sure that watch rotation is circadian friendly, is the term we use, so that they get they have an adequate amount of time to get sleep. Now, some people blow away that time and do silly things like play video games or whatever, and they actually lose sleep. Mm-hmm. So you have to very carefully plan for that, that 7 to 9 hours that you need every night. Now, did I get 7 to 9 hours every night? Hell no. But I tried. I really did try. And sometimes I did, which was a miracle. I get a lot of phone calls in the middle of the night, mandatory phone calls based on, something breaking, or maybe there's a missile airborne, that kind of stuff. Nice. But the other thing I did to help me sleep is I would read sci-fi novels. Something just completely different than what we were actually doing. Things about the future, fighting aliens, you know, that kind of stuff. And that to me was like, I still do that. Some people say, like, don't you read leadership books? I'm like, man, I moved on from that. Right. You know, what about history books? I'm like, yeah, I'll get back to that eventually. Yeah. Right now, just sci-fi. Okay.
For the record, I can't remember the last time I got a call about an airborne missile. It's been a while.
Right. Yeah.
Right. Yeah.
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 Well, is it coming for us? No, sir. All right. I'm going back to it. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, the point, too, about reading leadership books, I mean, at some point, you're living it every day. You wrote the way. I mean,
yeah, right? Application at this point. I've read some good leadership books in the past. They're pretty good. Most of them I just can't connect with, honestly. Some of them are just like tenets and without like the details and the how to. Yeah. I love what the Navy SEALs put out. They do great books. But the difference between them and me is they're working with like the most elite teams in America. Like it's still important to have strong leadership. There's just a different sort of clientele that they're dealing with. Mm-hmm. So my leadership would be, you know, how do you get several thousand people to care a little bit more? Yeah. That's sort of the book I would write.
Yeah.
Chadha, are your folks still around?
No, my parents have both passed away, but I do have a brother up in Quincy, Mass.
At what point did your dad pass away? How far in your naval career did he get to see you go?
He didn't see too much. It was, I think, early 2000s, 2001, 2002 time frame. So I was still a lieutenant at the time. I was at Top Gun for my first shore tour, if you will, as the lone E2 Hawkeye guy on the staff. And that was awesome. So I got to fly in F-18s in the back and and teach communications, like how to do air-to-air kills, essentially.
I love that. Well, I'm sure he would have been incredibly
proud. Was super proud of that, yeah. And I did do two different deployments. So he and I got to talk through those deployments before he passed away. So that was good.
Do you have a, I don't know, you guys know the language, a next post or a next job that you would like to do after this one? I know it's relatively new, but as you look at are you going to stay in the Navy for a while? I mean, what's your plan?
Well, I don't know. I leave in June and I will still have a year left in the Navy. You reach a statutory limit of 30. So I either will get out unless I promoted to Admiral, which I wouldn't find out until early next year anyway. So, I don't know at this point. Yeah. I have no job lined up.
Yeah.
So I'm looking for a job in the Navy. If anyone's out there, I'm ready. I can do good stuff for you.
One last question about the ship. I'm curious, and this goes back to this idea of peer support and where we all find what we need from a mental health perspective. How big is your senior leadership circle and how do you all work together?
We have two, for me, it's like two major layers. I have the triad. So you have the commanding officer, the executive officer, and the command master chief. Command master chief is the senior enlisted leader. And he's responsible for all the enlisted sailors, which we have a lot. So the three of us meet every single day. We kind of strategize our comms. We make decisions on, you know, things that happened, or make decisions about the future. We slap the table and we all speak with one voice when we leave that room. And I love that. There's a second element. I have the HODs, the heads of departments. So I have 20 departments on the ship. And every week I meet with all of them, or in onesies and twosies throughout the week. And so we do the same thing. We make decisions, we slap the table, we determine how we're going to do our comm strategy, and we go out and they go and lead their departments. And so that's kind of how it works. It probably not much different than any company and how they do business as well. Mm-hmm. But that communication is important. Like, you have to have those regular meetings, and make decisions and agree. And if there's disagreements that can happen on the side, you got to be open to feedback. And that does happen too. And then we'll, you know, recalibrate and come up with a new way of approaching the problem. I need that feedback.
Would that triad be a room in which one of you might notice that the other is struggling or might need additional support?
That could happen. Yes. I've had in the past, members of triad, you know, sit down one-on-one with me and say, I'm going through I've had some go through divorces, some go through some personal problems. And we're all humans and things happen and we do our very best to accommodate that. But again, at the end of the day, everyone, if you need help, you got to talk. You can't suffer in silence, whether it's talking to me or a therapist or, you know, your best friend or your spouse. I mean, we have to come together as humans.
Amen. Slapping the table, is that your thing or is that a Navy thing?
Oh, it's probably a military expression. We agree and then we bam, slap the table and everyone smiles and we walk out. Yeah.
Because I'm wondering if you can sense if somebody is not like totally into it, they half-ass slap the table. And it's like, wait. That's not a good slap. That's what's going on.
If you have a little bit of emotional intelligence, you should be able to read a room like that. Right?
Yes. Yeah.
And then you could take them one-on-one. I'm like, okay, what's going on here? You don't agree with this policy? Let's talk about it.
Yeah.
We're pretty good. But again, we're in the military. We follow orders, right? Even sometimes we don't like them.
Right.
We can question them. We can push back. That's all fine. But when a decision is made, we're going to do it, right?
Yeah.
Shauna, we don't want to keep you too long, although I wish we could. We do have three sort of canned questions we ask our guests at the end. Before I do that, and you don't have a choice, by the way, so this is not optional.
Crap.
You're giving them an order? Is that what you're doing?
Yeah, give them an order.
There was no preparation for the answers to these questions. Got it.
That's the way we like it. Before we go into that, is there anything else that you wish you had a chance to say or would like to say about the Ike, about serving in the military, about anything?
I think I do have an appeal to young folks because I was talking to some high schoolers recently and one of them said, hey, I'm not sure I could handle the training, you know, it just doesn't seem to fit with me. And it made me think, I'm like, well, hold on a second. I think pretty much if you're healthy, you can handle the training. Like, everyone that we have at our boot camps and every service, their number one goal is to get you through that process. They want you to succeed, right? They take pleasure in when you put on that uniform and you salute for the first time. That is a wonderful experience for all the instructors. We live for that. So that shouldn't be an impediment, is what I'm saying. If you want to join the military, please do. Is it dangerous? Yes. But we need people like you who can think, who can and survive through challenging scenarios and just make a difference in the world, because we do make a difference in the world. Mm-hmm. When we go somewhere, especially an aircraft carrier, it influences every country around us. They're talking about it. We're in the newspaper. It might affect their decision-making at the highest levels just by presence. Mm-hmm. So, you could be 18, 19 years old and being part of history. I mean, to me, that's fascinating, right? So mm-hmm. I appeal to them. I said, you know, even though they're probably not listening to your program because we're all old dudes, right? But maybe the parents are, right? Hello, parents.
Yeah.
You know, I am not a unicorn here. There are a lot of people like me and a lot of leaders who care about sailors. And I've met several online. I've met several in my career. I am not unusual. Let's just put it that way. Mm-hmm. All right. I'm ready for the questions.
Well, let me just quickly follow up. You talked about happiness earlier, as happiness being fleeting. Sometimes it's not constant. I have always said something similar about my time serving, you know, from 92 to 98 in the Navy, where I wasn't always happy. It didn't always bring me joy, but I've never been prouder of anything else I've done. So I love your call to action. So,
well, and I also want to say, you know, you say you're not unusual, and I want to emphasize that in the best way. I don't know where else I could find a document like The Way anywhere else. Point me to it if there is one, but it's a pretty special statement about how you want to lead and how you consider the people under your command. So that is unusual in the best way.
Yeah, no, thanks. I think some people naturally do those things without putting it into writing. So I just had an extra time, 1 week to put that in writing. So I did. So, but yeah, I'm not that unusual.
Maybe. Yeah.
Yeah. I was kind of hoping it all happened in one night, like it did for Jerry Maguire, but off to the printer, off to the Kinko's or whatever it was.
I got to see that movie again.
Yeah. I know. It's a good one. It's a good
one. I remember that part.
All right. This is the quiz show portion, not a quiz show. This is kind of like Inside the Actor's Studio, if you ever watch that show. First question, Chada, is what do you wish you could have told your 10-year-old self?
I think that it's, I would have told him, who is very shy little boy, that was afraid to talk to people, that that fear is normal and it will never go away, but you will find a way to harness it so that you can communicate better. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yep.
Hell yeah, it does.
And you're, it never goes away. Study. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. What, imagine what your 10-year-old self would have thought if you told him he was going to command an aircraft carrier someday.
Yeah. I've had kids. They don't care about that stuff. Like, okay, whatever. Right. Where's my sandwich? But like it's okay to be weird. I would say that as well. It's okay to be different. Mm-hmm. And that becomes what makes you special. And it will make other people who are weird feel special, I guess. That's probably what I tell little Chris Hill.
I love that. Yep. Second question, Chada, is do you have a mantra in life or even a mantra these days?
A mantra is a set of words or word that you would use when you're meditating. Is that what you're asking me?
Yeah, not necessarily when you're meditating, but to remind yourself in an effort to stay centered, for example.
I don't. I will look at my own Way of the Warrior Sailor from time to time and say, am I doing what I said I'm supposed to do? Mm-hmm. And so I will, for instance, I was like, you know what? Mission and purpose. We don't have the mission and purpose of actually being in the Red Sea. So what can I do? And I was like, you know what? I'm going to do post-deployment briefs to my own sailors. So every week or every 2 weeks now, I bring them into a room and I tell them what happened on deployment, because they don't get the full story that I get from my perspective. So I'm giving them a chance to have to be able to tell the story as well by giving them the details. And they seem to appreciate that. So, to love and value people, am I doing it or not? Am I providing mission and purpose or not? And am I creating that winning environment? For winning environment, like just yesterday, as a matter of fact, I got on the 1MC. I said, congratulations, we achieved our first major objective of the shipyard. We started the shipyard period, which was on Monday. But in order to start the shipyard period, we decided we were going to do 15,000 man days of actual work. And we actually accomplished those 15,000 man days. I know man days sounds like a funny word, but human days, whatever, right? We actually met our objectives going into the shipyard. So that was, boom, milestone, key event. Complete number one, that's a win. What's next? And so we've already approved a list of our next wins. We're just waiting to put them out. And once we get a win, we're setting up this big poster thing that'll be hanging, that once we get the next milestone, boom, we'll put that up. I will announce that it's done. In some cases, we'll even have like a cake and celebrate the victory, right? I even picked an arbitrary one called the 100-day milestone. It's just a number. Right, it's a round number, but it's 100 days. So we're going to have a cake that says 100 on it, right? And just declare wins. Try to keep that going in the shipyard environment.
Yeah.
I love that. Well, two quick follow-ups to that. You guys aren't in dry dock right now, right?
We're pier side, not in a dry dock. But it's the level of work is similar to a dry dock period. Just I have thousands of shipyard workers, again, Americans, salt of the earth, patriotic, overhauling all aspects of the ship needs it's old, and every ship needs it every few years, so you're familiar with that process.
The second follow-up is, I was kind of hoping you would say your mantra is, what was the sign-off you used to use in the 1MC? Follow the way, or
this is the way.
This is the way. Right? Yes. Like, which is effectively what you said. Like, am I staying true to my proclamation? Right.
So, right. I will tell you, I said it so often that it appeared on at least 3 human bodies as tattoos during that deployment. So every Tuesday I would say Taco Tuesday, my absolute favorite day of the week, and. Two sailors got Taco Tuesday tattoos on their calves. I posted that online. You can see it yourself.
You're like a proud papa.
I am, right? And that's funny. It's the power of words and leadership and communication and how you can get into people's minds. And if you're positive, imagine what you can do.
Yeah.
That's great.
Yep.
Well, the final question is a little bit heavier, maybe, but it is this: what do you hope that people will say about you at your wake?
This is a guy who gave a damn about other people. I want that to be known. And whether or not it's true, I think it, I don't know. That's a tough one. That's a tough one. But I'm asking everyone else to give a damn. I hopefully people think that I do. And I do. I struggle with feelings of, you know, inadequacy, like I'm not doing enough. There's also this phenomenon where you feel like a fraud. Like, what am I doing here? Who put me in this position? I'm just a regular broken human being. I hope I could change a few lives. It's hard. Like in life, you can't change people that much. Right. Yeah. But if I could just change a few, like some people I have trouble changing my daughter's lives. Right. For the positive. Yeah. But if I can change a handful, I'd be happy with that.
But you said it at the beginning, we can't change other people, but we can love them and we can value them. And
yes.
And then maybe that's enough that they see a different way.
Maybe that's enough. Maybe that's more than enough. And you know, the reason why I chose to love and value a little bit more extreme words there is because we're so used to saying to treat people with dignity and respect. I said, what's the next step? Right. The next step is to love and value. That's what I say.
Yep.
Well, right. And you know, we all do what we can to help people's lives be better, but the necessary requisite to that is giving a damn, right? So
yeah.
at a minimum, that's what we
give
we
a damn.
Strive for.
Yeah.
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 Captain Chris Chowdahill, man, thanks again for joining us. It's so nice to spend time with you. Thanks to you and thanks to the whole crew of the USS Eisenhower as well for your service.
Yeah.
Thank you. I'll pass that along. And so thanks, gentlemen. A good show and some tough questions. Appreciate it.
This is Chris. Thanks again for joining us on this episode of If You've Come This Far.
And this is Sean. Remember to check us out, mnliving.org.